This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
Oh, great God and loving Heavenly Father, we praise you for all that you do on our behalf. We know, Lord, that you are the one who upholds all things. And you're also the one who knows us each as individuals. We thank you, Lord, for the way you sustain us and provide for our daily needs. And we thank you, too, for the way you provide for our greatest need of all, and that is the righteousness by which we can stand before you. For we know, Lord, that we've sinned. We have fallen very far short of the standards of your law. And so, O God, even as we turn from our wickedness and rebellion, we look to your Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, and grasp him by faith, that we might be clothed with his perfect righteousness. Lord, continue with us today. Give us hearts and minds that are receptive to your truth and that are committed to our earthly callings. And we pray, O Lord, that all that we say and think and do this day might be done conscious of your presence, conscious of your claim on our lives, and to your glory, for we ask this in his name. Amen. Okay, we're just rounding off Calvin today. We talked briefly last week about various controversies with which he was involved, culminating in the clash with Servetus, Michael Servetus, one of the most brilliant but also one of the most heretical men of his generation. And Servetus, of course, is finally tried and executed on the, the 26th of October, 1553. Anybody know 26th of October is an important historical date for other reasons? My youngest son's birthday, but that's not the important historical event that took place. A major event in American history, 26th of October. Gunfight at the OK Corral. So anyway, far more important than the Declaration of Independence or Thanksgiving or anything like that. Anyway, 1550s were also marked for Calvin by his struggles with what he called the Libertines. These were essentially old Genevan families. Now, you'll remember the Calvin story is really one whereby the old Genevan families are instrumental in his recall to Geneva in 1541. Remember, he's expelled in 1538, but he's called back in 1541, partly as a way of providing some sort of strong leadership within Geneva that will allow them to an extent, resist the Bernese. Though, as we saw in the way that Calvin's proposals for church order are modified, there is still a great need to appease the Bernese. Essentially, in Geneva, you have a choice. You can either be Catholic and look to the House of Savoy for your military support, or you can be Protestant and look to the city of Bern for your military support. The old Genevans supported Calvin's return, but during the later 1540s and then in the early 1550s really turned against him with something of a vengeance. I think there are a number of factors at play there. One, Calvin was clearly not going to be a stooge of these men. They may have brought him in, but he has his own very firm opinions on what the church should look like in Geneva. So you don't have the comfortable relationship between Calvin and the Genevan authorities that you would find, let's say, between Zwingli or Bullinger and the authorities in Zurich. The second element of it, I think, is that ethnic tension aspect that I talked about a couple of classes ago. You have significant French immigration into Geneva during Calvin's time. And immigration is always a source of tension and stress. It's no different today to what it was in the 16th century. And that is coupled with a perception that the consistory meted out harsher punishments for Genevans than it did for French immigrants. Calvin portrays the conflicts in which he engages with the so-called libertines as a theological struggle, that you have men in Geneva who really bristle under the religious rigor that Calvin and his colleagues and the company of pastors attempt to bring to the city. The truth, I think, is more complicated. As I said, the truth is there are a number of reasons for the tension. And Calvin's use of the language of libertinism is a brilliant rhetorical ploy. You often see this, certainly saw it in Scotland in the 80s and 90s when the churches in the city, and I was at Bon Accord Free Church of Scotland in Aberdeen, a small city on the northeast coast of Scotland. The churches in the cities were typically under suspicion by the churches in the west coast and in the islands of Scotland. And there's a big, you know, the west coast islands, it's small rural communities. The city is a more cosmopolitan context. But the language that was used was that of liberal and conservative. You know, the churches in the cities are more liberal. By and large, that was not really being used as a theological category. It was being used as a category to refer to how the churches transacted their business and how Christians in those cities looked and comported themselves day by day. But the rhetorical strategy of using language of liberalism in order to sort of demonize the opponent, you see that in Calvin's Geneva. I think with his language of the, with his use of the language of libertine, we're thinking, you know, are these a bunch of licentious hippie types running around the city in a state of undress? Probably not. They're traditional old Genevan families who are banging heads with Calvin. And that is causing problems. By the mid-1550s, particularly in the wake of the Servetus trial and then victory at the polls in 1555, Calvin's people gain a majority on the city councils. And indeed, as a sort of tit for tat, the city of Bern withdraws its military support at that point, which causes the Genevans in 1558 to actually renew the treaties to look back to Bern for military support. The price they pay for that is that the Bernese throw the Calvinist pastors in Lausanne, one of the neighboring areas to Geneva, out of their homes, just as a sort of bit of petty vengeance. But by the late 1550s, Calvin's position is now finally secure in Geneva. You know, he dies in 1564. So really, it's only in the last 5 or 6 years of his life that he enjoys security in Geneva. And again, that should play into how we perceive Calvin's role in Genevan life and politics. At no point did he fulfill a role analogous to the Ayatollahs in Iran, for example, which is often one of the analogies used. Calvin's own personal position was never as secure as the religious leaders in a place like Iran or even Saudi Arabia. Other important factors playing into the last few years of Calvin's life, well, slightly earlier, the Consensus Tigurinus was a document signed in 1549. It was a joint agreement on the Lord's Supper between the Genevans and the Zwinglians, the men of Zurich, used by Charles Hodge in the 19th century to argue that Calvin occupied a fundamentally Zwinglian position, really, on the Lord's Supper. There is this famous debate in the 19th century between John Calvin and a theologian at Mercersburg, John Williamson Nevin. And I think it's fair to say that Nevin probably gets Calvin more right than Hodge does. Part of Hodge's evidence for Calvin being a Zwinglian is he signs the Consensus Tigurinus. Well, the Consensus Tigurinus is essentially just touches on those areas where the Calvinists and the Zwinglians agreed. It doesn't touch on the areas where they disagreed. And it's those areas of the spiritual feeding on Christ in the Lord's Supper where one would find disagreement between the Calvinists and the men of Zurich. So the Consensus Tigurinus, 1549, very important. Creation of the Academy in 1559 is significant too. And the man who will be brought in to head up the Academy is Theodore Beza. Beza often gets blamed for all manner of bad theological stuff that's supposed to have gone on in the latter part of the 16th and early 17th centuries. Beza is a much more urbane and entertaining character than that. In his early days before his conversion, he wrote erotic poetry. Yeah, he wrote naughty poetry. And after he was converted, the Roman Catholics reprinted and republished this stuff. Beza made a famous comment that these people deny me my repentance, he said. So he had quite a colorful background. He and his wife got into trouble because they decorated their house too nicely in Geneva. And there were people in Geneva who felt it was inappropriate for a minister to live in a house that was nicely decorated. So Beza's an interesting character. Years ago, a friend of mine was the assistant librarian at the University of Cambridge, and he took me up to the head librarian's office. And outside the head librarian's office at Cambridge, next to the door of his office, is a beautiful picture of Theodore Beza, who, if you were doing a study of beards in the Reformation, Beza would be up there in the top three, I think, this magnificent white beard that tapered to a point. Why would Beza's picture be hanging outside the door of the head librarian at the University of Cambridge, which is one of the great libraries in the world, of course? He would have a nice, no doubt he would have a nice office, but many men have had nice offices. Al Mohler, I think, looking at the videos, has a nice office. His portrait does not hang there. Why does Beza's hang there and Al Mohler's doesn't? Yep. Which manuscript did he give to the University of Cambridge, which is their greatest, in this wonderful collection of books, is probably their single greatest treasure. Which is it? Codex Bezae. If you've got your Nestle Aland out and you flick through it and look down in the critical apparatus, you'll see references to Codex Bezae. It's one of the most important codices of the New Testament. And it was donated by Theodore Beza. I don't know how he'd come by it. I'll have to look that up. He probably stole it from somebody down the line. All property is theft, as was it Proudhon said that? Anyway, Beza donated it to the University of Cambridge in the 16th century, and it remains there to this day. I've seen it, and it is probably the single greatest treasure that the library possesses. One of my students told me how he went to see one of the Dead Sea Scrolls some years ago, and he managed somehow to bluff his way into them. The museum where they were being displayed, the guy took it out of the cabinet to show him, and in his excitement, he spluttered. And he said that the whole world seemed to slow into slow motion as he saw this bit of spit flying through the air and landed splat right on one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we have Westminster students doing damage and ruining treasures across the world. Codex Bezae, very, very important for New Testament textual studies. Beza was a humanist, trained as a humanist, as he was a poet before he became Reformed, and he is really the man who heads up Geneva into the, organizes the Reformation after Calvin. Last week I was in a pastor's study down in Atlanta in Georgia, and hanging on the wall was a 19th century print representing the Reformation in Geneva. And what was interesting about this print was, you have a group of reformers in the background. You've got Calvin, Luther, Zwingli and company. And standing separate at the front was Theodore Beza. And that reflects that in 19th century Geneva, Beza was regarded as the key figure in the Genevan Reformation, and not Calvin. It was a fascinating piece of artwork. Anyway, we shall come back to Beza later in the course. Beza is the man who heads up the academy from 1559. Calvin himself dies. He preaches for the last time on the 6th of February, 1564, and dies on May the 27th of that year, just after being visited. Well, the town council process and visit him in April of that year. So Calvin finally accepted, really, by the establishment in Geneva. But his life is marked by conflict. And that conflict is generated partly by theology and partly by the fact that he is a foreigner in exile in a city where he undoubtedly becomes the most influential man in the city, but where there are old establishment figures who oppose him. We shall come back to Calvin as we move into more thematic discussions as this course proceeds. But we now want to move again. We're going to shift geographically. We've gone from Wittenberg down to Zurich, across to Geneva. We're now going to track northwest and look at the Reformation in England. The Reformation takes different paths all over Europe. One of the things I like about the Carter Lindbergh book is the plural in the title, the European Reformations. Reformation comes to different countries in different ways, and it takes different forms. And one of the most contentious places for Reformation scholarship is the English Reformation. And scholarship really breaks down into two camps. The dominant camp is the camp headed up by Eamon Duffy. You'll find his name on the original bibliography I gave you. Eamon Duffy is one of the Reformation historians at the University of Cambridge in England, where he works with his colleague, Richard Rex. Richard is an old friend of mine. I don't know Professor Duffy. I do know Richard. They're both very conservative Roman Catholic scholars, so they don't like the Reformation anyway. But their essential argument is that the English Reformation is, by and large, an act of state imposed from the top down by the crown on an unwilling or indifferent people. There is another school of thought, most famously articulated by the historian A.G. Dickens, though to some extent maintained by Dermot McCulloch, whose book on the Reformation I've recommended to you and whose biography of Thomas Cranmer is one of the greatest biographies ever written in any field. There's a second school of thought that argues that the Reformation actually struck a popular chord in England and was not simply imposed from above, but also was something that came from beneath as well. It's a debate that it's difficult, I think, to come down decisively on one side or the other, because the evidential base, as we shall see, is fairly narrow. And if the base of your evidence is fairly narrow, it's difficult to draw grandstanding conclusions. But it points us to the fact that the story of the English Reformation begins well before the Reformation. Really, England enjoys something of a unique position in Europe in the Middle Ages. Why would that be? It's an island. Good, Annales historian there. Geography can make a huge difference to the way people think and behave. Think of your own, those of you Americans, think of your own nation. The sheer space, I mean, unless you've lived in a smaller place, you have no idea of the space that there is in North America. And, of course, if you look at 19th century American history, the expanding western frontier is very significant for the way Americans think about the world. The rest of us in the world, we always joke about the fact that American presidents, you know, once they're elected president, then they have to apply for a passport because, you know, Americans don't travel abroad. Well, on one level, there's no need because you've got so much here. You know, why do you need to travel abroad? You can travel 3,000 miles, it seems, and still be in your own country. So, America, the sheer size of America makes a difference. Even impacts Presbyterian polity. Scottish Presbyterianism is distinctive. The Presbyterian in my background is distinctive in a number of ways from American Presbyterianism. One of those ways is the power of the General Assembly. The General Assembly in Scotland typically has more power than General Assemblies here. One, that sort of reflects the difference in secular government arrangements, but it also reflects geography. Everybody can get in touch with everybody else relatively quickly in a small geographical area. As you go westward, it becomes more and more difficult to have any kind of centralized power in the 19th century. It also actually affects, this is slightly sad but sort of also amusing if you have a sadistic sense of humor, which I do, in case you hadn't noticed. Just in that, you may have missed that subtlety in my makeup there. It also affects some of the things that are not in the Westminster Confession. In the original Westminster Standards, there is a piece about you're not allowed to marry your dead wife's sister. It's that sort of degrees of consanguinity thing. That's gone, I think, from the American Confession now. And that's to do with the frontier. If you think about the expansion of the American frontier, what happens in the 19th century? You're heading west, and you go out and you start farming in Iowa or Wyoming or somewhere like that, and you have 3, 4, 5 children, and your wife dies. Well, your wife needs help, so what do? You send back to the city for her sister. Her unmarried sister comes out to help you on the farm. And then at some point, your wife dies. So you're in the middle of nowhere, and the only lady for hundreds of miles is your dead wife's sister. And you fall in love, and you get married. And this pops up as a problem in America, I think, like nowhere else in the 19th century because of the expansion of the frontier. And there was a famous long-running legal case within the Presbyterian Church where some guy hounded some other guy through the church for marrying his dead wife's sister. It's really miserable what this individual inflicted on this poor chap. And at the end of this case, it was decided simply to drop that bit from the confession because it was just proving problematic. But there's an example of how geography and social arrangements impact what's actually written in the Westminster Confession. So geography makes a difference. England is an island, and if you look at medieval English history, England has always exerted a great deal of independence from the papacy, because it is very difficult for the Pope to be able to impose his will upon an island. If the king doesn't like it, what's the Pope going to do about it? Is he going to invade? Last successful invasion of England was 1066, the 11th century, the Norman conquest was the last successful invasion of England. So there is a tradition, and we shall look next week, there is actually a tradition of legal precedent within England limiting papal power, because the English crown can get away with it. Now, those of you who are sharp and clever might say, well, what about Scotland? Well, the interesting thing about Scotland is they hate the English. So what do? Well, they tend to have treaties with France. My wife is Scottish, and I would say, you can tell a lot about a nation when it has historic treaties with France. I think that's very morally significant as far as I'm concerned. But Scotland has an interest in being more Catholic because it's a way of not being English, a little bit like Canadians. It's one of your Canadian friends, and they pretend to be British. It's wonderful to watch them in action. They're really Americans, and I love to. Sandy Finlayson, the librarian, is a friend of mine, and I love to provoke him by talking about North American culture. You want to upset the librarian here. Ask him a question about North American culture, and he will go through the roof, I guarantee you. And if he knows I put you up to it, it'll make him even more angry. But England has been much more independent of the papacy. By the time the Reformation arrives, it has a tradition, even within its law code. And we'll see, that'll be significant because some of those laws will be used to implement the Reformation. The 16th century Reformation in England is built in part on medieval laws passed by Parliament. So having laid out that general picture then, what are the specifics? What can we say is particularly going on in the Middle Ages in England that may well be paving the way for Reformation? And this is where the big debate occurs between these scholars like Duffy and McCulloch. It's the role of Lollardy. Lollardy is the movement of lay preaching that emerges in the wake of the writings of John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe dates roughly 1329 to 1384. He is a fairly high-powered Oxford philosopher. Wycliffe's major contributions intellectually are philosophical contributions. He's a philosophical realist. He does a lot of work on the nature of language. He also develops his realism leads him to critique the notion of the Mass, the fact that bread and wine are predicated of the bread and wine means that bread and wine must be there after the words of institution by the priest. So he doesn't like transubstantiation. And he also develops a radical predestinarian theology that pulls the rug away from the power of the Pope. For Wycliffe, the Church is the totality of the predestined. He's a good medieval theologian. He doesn't believe that anyone can know they're of the predestined. And therefore, the Pope cannot know that he's one of the predestined. So the Pope cannot know for certain he's a member of the Church. Therefore, the Pope cannot claim any powers relative to the Church. And Wycliffe was a radical who wanted to get away with all office within the Church. Did not believe. He was your ultimate anti-clerical theologian in many ways. And in its place as an authority structure, Wycliffe argued that the Church should essentially be an arm of the state. That's a very significant intellectual move. It will be refined and articulated in a much more compelling way by later generations, but within the history of English intellectual thought, the idea of the Church as a subservient arm of the state comes to prominence in the Middle Ages. And this will be the intellectual fodder for the English Reformation. Because if you know about the shape of the English Reformation, you'll know that initially, at least, it's nothing to do with justification by grace through faith. It's nothing to do with the scriptural principle. It's nothing to do with the sovereignty of God. It's everything to do with getting rid of the Pope and making the king head of the Church. They will change the language to make him supreme governor of the Church eventually. But the English Reformation, in terms of its initial form, is a political move whereby the papacy is driven out of England and power, church power, comes to be focused on the crown. And refracted through the constitutional changes of the late 17th century, that is essentially the position that holds today. The Queen is the person who ultimately appoints the Archbishop of Canterbury. I believe what happens is that the Prime Minister will go to the Queen with two names, and the Queen has to choose one of the two names. Now, obviously, it's a constitutional monarchy. She would take consultation from church, etc., etc. But it is ultimately the Queen that makes the appointment of the Archbishop of Canterbury. In other words, she stands above the Church on that level. In the famous woodcut that we will look at in a few classes' time, there's a famous woodcut of Henry VIII sitting on his throne with the Pope under his feet. He's got his feet on the Pope, and he's holding the Bible and the sword. And that symbolizes the dual power of the monarchy, that the monarch has both power in church and in state. So the intellectual culture for the English Reformation is already being set in the Middle Ages. How does this connect to debates and questions about the popular reception of the English Reformation? Well, it really comes down to how many people did Wycliffe influence? Wycliffe himself was a very boring, medieval metaphysician. But he sponsored two translations of the Bible, the so-called Lollard Bibles. He didn't translate the Bible. His followers did, but he encouraged and sponsored it. They were, of course, translations from the Latin, not from the Greek and the Hebrew. And they were, of course, handwritten, expensive, painfully slow to produce. But Wycliffe's vernacular translations of the Bible appear to have fueled a movement of lay preaching that operated below the surface of society. Now, a few comments to make about groups like that. If you think of underground heretical movements as the equivalent of modern-day terrorist organizations, By and large, these groups tend not to advertise their existence and tend not to leave great paper trails behind them. So often we know of their existence by hints or surreptitious references in other texts. For example, in the 1530s, an English reformer known as John Frith comes back. He's in exile on the continent. He returns to Kent in England, and he meets with some brethren there. We don't know who these brethren are, but we do know that they were some kind of underground Protestant cell. That much is clear from the reference. But we don't know who belonged to them. We don't know what they did. We don't know what they believed. We don't know how they organized themselves. Lollardy operates on that kind of level. It's an underground movement. It's a popular lay movement. These people were not occupying high office. They were not writing diaries. They didn't have, you know, Twitter accounts, you know, off to Lollard meeting, laughing out loud or something, hashtag underground heresy. You know, they didn't do stuff like that. It allows us to reconstruct them. And this is where the big debate takes place in English Reformation studies. Guy like A.G. Dickens wants to say there were lots of these groups around, that Catholicism in England had become so corrupt that even the common people were getting fed up of it. And so the Lollard lay preaching groups actually exerted considerable influence at levels of society where we don't have written records of what was going on. But we get hints, as like Dickens and Dermot McCulloch would say, we get hints of their existence from things like formulas in wills. You know, normally people would sign off their will with, you know, requests to get the saints in heaven to pray for them, or a, you know, nice reference to Mary. If you have wills in the 15th century, early 16th century, before the Reformation, that sign off specifically saying we don't want saints to pray for us, or lambasting the cult of Mary, well, something's going on here, isn't it? These people are coming from a particular... Remember what I said a couple of weeks ago? The normal never needs explanation in history. The normal thing is to sign off your will with a nice Catholic flourish. If you don't do that, why don't you do it? Indicates some kind of background of a proto or quasi-Protestant nature. They'd also look at heresy trials. The 15th century, early in the 15th century, a statute is passed, De Hieretico Comburendo. It's on the handout on the web. On the necessity of burning a heretic. That's actually the legislation that will be used in the 1550s for burning Protestants, medieval legislation. That's passed in order to dispatch Lollards, by and large. Records of heresy trials. Somebody pops up who, you know, claims the Pope is the Antichrist and the Mass is an idol. Evidence of underground Lollard activity. But there are methodological problems with drawing grand conclusions from that kind of evidence. You know, let's think as historians for a moment. First of all, formulas in wills. What's going to be the basic issue about formulas in wills? Well, it's the nature of the sample, isn't it? You know, people who actually have wills are a pretty small subsection of the overall population. So trying to extrapolate grand conclusions about support for Lollardy based on formulas in wills, as I said earlier on, it's a narrow evidential basis. We don't know exactly what it might represent. What's the problem with heresy trials? Could be, although often in the heresy trials you've got a more of a cross-section of society, so it's a broader sample. But that's one problem, but there's another problem with heresy trial as well. Yeah, sort of like that. If you think about it, you know, I grew up in a home which was a devout Roman Catholic home, and the local priest was a real tyrant. And he used to come around and beat me black and blue if I misbehaved for my parents. And I grew up hating the Roman Catholic Church as a result. And I end up, this is the Middle Ages, and I declare, I think the Pope is an antichrist and the Mass is just an idol. Does it mean I'm part of an organized underground Lollard cell? It could just mean I don't like the local priest and I'm wanting to poke him in the eye over something. Problem with heresy trials is that not every heresy trial is indicative of membership of an organized heretical organization. So the problem with trying to argue for widespread Lollard influence is we just don't know. We don't have the evidence that really allows us to draw grand conclusions. On the other side, of course, we don't really have the evidence that allows us to deny these things. And that's where I think, personally, that one has to say that perhaps the confessional bias of some of the historians kicks in. A.G. Dickens was a good old Protestant man, inclined perhaps to read the evidence in a bit of a pro-Protestant way. Eamon Duffy is a devout Roman Catholic, and just perhaps that influences the way he might read the Lollard evidence. Though Duffy makes stronger case, because Duffy will also look at particular villages and towns and see how vibrant, for example, pilgrimages were to local shrines as a way of demonstrating that Catholicism enjoyed particular vibrancy on the eve of the Reformation in England. So all of that is a long-winded way of saying, we just don't know. We don't know. Was the English Reformation imposed from above? Or did it rise up from the ranks and coincide with the interests of the ruling classes? We don't know. Could have been either. By and large, I guess I'd have to say at that point, I ceased to be that interested in the question because the evidence is so equivocal. My own take, just for what it's worth, is I think that just as the Reformation is diverse across Europe and one size does not fit all, so I think the influence of Lollardy in England is probably diverse and one size does not fit all. My own home county of Gloucestershire, I think there is significant evidence of Lollard activity there. Manuscript sermons, that kind of thing. There also appears to have been evidence of activities in Kent, which, interestingly enough, then connects with these weird references to the Brethren in Kent that we get in the 1530s. There also appear to have been in the Midlands, right in the centre of England, there have been discovered cycles of Lollard sermons. Well, if there are sermons there, there must be somebody writing and speaking them, and presumably there's a market for them as well. So I suspect that Lollard activity is sporadic, but is significant in certain areas. The major driving factor in the English Reformation, though, has to be the political aspect to it. Just as an aside, if you want a really radical take on the Lollards, look at my friend Richard Rex's book called The Lollards. I remember pulling his leg about the fact that I was amazed that given that he thought there were so few Lollards around, I was stunned that he actually used the plural in the title. But it's an interesting, hardcore anti-Lollard take on the evidence. It's a fairly short book. So Lollardy, then, one major factor. England has its own proto-Reformation movement in the 15th century. It also, Lollardy, shapes English political attitudes to Bible translation. It is interesting that Bible translation is disapproved of in England like nowhere else in Europe, the time of the Reformation, because Bible translation already has a bad rap with the people in power. Bible translation equals political and social subversion in England. It's connected to Lollardy. There are all kinds of rhetorical connections. Also, I suspect one would have to add that there are probably more substantial connections than the mere rhetorical. There are a number of sociological studies done in South America in the 1960s that demonstrated that as literacy grew in societies where there'd been a lot of illiteracy, so political radicalism grew as well. literacy and political awareness grow hand in hand. So probably the prevalence of Bible translation in England in the hands of radicals is not a sociologically random occurrence. But you've got a translation of the Bible into German that's perfectly okay in 1466. That's when you get, I think, the first decent German translation of the Bible, the Mentell Bible. England will not have a translation of the Bible into English, an official one, until the 1530s, relatively late. So Lollardy then casts a long shadow over England prior to the Reformation. The English Reformation really takes off in the 1520s and 1530s, so again one would have to say it's a relatively late occurrence, and there is no Protestant settlement in England until 1547, well, really 1549. Things start to shift dramatically in 1547. But the English Reformation comes late. By the time we have significant English reformers emerging, continental Reformation theology is already taking significant confessional shape. If Calvin was second generation after Luther, and he grew up in a world already shaped by the Reformation and Reformation theology, the significant English reformers, many of them are even later than Calvin. The earliest reformational sort of impact on England appears to come in the 1520s and 1530s from Anabaptists, radical groups that are operating in England. Cromwell, in 1535, sends a memo, a number of memos out under the heading, "What will the king," that is Henry VIII, "do with the Anabaptists?" This is Thomas Cromwell, by the way, not Oliver, who's a century later. And we know that in the 1530s, a number of heretical foreigners were arrested on English soil. We also know before 1535 that an Anabaptist, Janietje, taste doctor, had been arrested and forced to repent. So early evidence is that Reformation comes to England through more radical elements than the Orthodox. We also have the typical medieval background to the English Reformation. There is a strong devotional aspect to late medieval English Christianity. Works by Meister Eckhart and Tauler were very popular in the 14th and 15th century. England produced a number of its own mystics. The Anonymous Cloud of Unknowing, the work of Richard Roll, 14th century, Walter Hilton, contemplative mystics. The Devotio Moderna also had its own adherents. The modern devotion, we talked about that as the background to Calvin. Early 16th century, humanism. Humanism starts to strike deep roots. Dean John Collett of Oxford, dates 1466 to 1519, friend of Erasmus, inspired by Erasmus with the ideals of Christian humanism. Remember, that is this confluence of literary interests with social reform. The idea of the Christian life as one of practical, simple morality. And also at a methodological level, an attempt to return exegesis to a more straightforward reading of the biblical text, less time for allegorical interpretation. Collett and Erasmus and their crowd inspired a generation of younger scholars, particularly, I have to say, at the University of Cambridge. Doesn't surprise one that the University of Cambridge would be on the cutting edge of the truth in the 16th century. Oxford was to remain a much more reactionary university. In fact, right down to the present day, I do believe. Your dad's a Cambridge graduate, isn't he, as well? Excellent. So, good man. Erasmus, at the turn of the 15th, 16th century, had been professor of Greek at Cambridge. And in the wake of Erasmus's influence, when we reach the early 1520s, we become aware of a group of young intellectuals who gather to discuss the latest learning at the White Horse Inn. Some of you will be familiar, no doubt, with the podcast, maybe on the radio as well, of Michael Horton, Kim Riddlebarger and company, do this thing called the White Horse Inn. It's great fun to listen to. They address some pretty serious subjects in a very thoughtful way. And it's taken its name from this gathering of intellectuals that took place in the 1520s. Interestingly, however, the White Horse Inn, despite its popular reputation as a gathering of radical Protestants, was not really a radical Protestant gathering. It was a gathering of men interested in the latest ideas. One or two of the members of the White Horse Inn group went on to become notorious architects of the Catholic reaction against Protestantism in the 1550s that we'll talk about later, in a later class. So don't allow Mike's podcast to shape how you think of the White Horse Inn. Many of the later intellectual leaders of the early English Reformation were members of this group. But it was not a distinctively Protestant group. It was really, I think, much more of a humanist group. I think I've given you some names on the handout of people who gathered there. Thomas Bilney, Robert Barnes. There was a legend, I think John Fox in his book of in Acts and Monuments has William Tyndale as a member of it, but I don't think there's any evidence that Tyndale ever attended Cambridge University. Stephen Gardner goes on to be a ferocious anti-Protestant. Miles Coverdale, one of the great early Protestant translators of the Bible into English. Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Ridley, men who were ultimately to die tied to the same stake on the same day. So it would have been an exciting group to belong to. The White Horse Inn does not exist. If you go to Cambridge, you cannot find it. I believe that the site on which it stands is now where part of St. Catherine's College is built. That's my old college. I could feel the power as I walked through the door. So the White Horse Inn is essentially a reading group, and it's this group that become interested in the writings of people like Erasmus, and then as they start to make their way into England in the 1520s, the works of people like Martin Luther as well. An example of the strangeness, though, of early English Protestants, provided by a man like Thomas Bilney. Bilney's the convener of the White Horse Inn group. He's the senior man who gathers these guys together to talk about this stuff. He was born in 1495 over in the east of England in Norfolk, which is pretty much a Catholic stronghold. Graduates from Cambridge, is ordained as a priest in 1519. But while reading Erasmus, undergoes some kind of conversion to what appears to be a basic understanding of justification by faith. He remains, till his dying day, orthodox on the supremacy of the Pope, the authority of the Church, transubstantiation, and the necessity of confession. He's burned at the stake as a Protestant, but even John Fox finds it difficult to explain why on earth he was burned as a Protestant, because he's only just over the line, so to speak. He's the man who convenes this group. Ultimately, he falls foul of the authorities and is arrested and burned in August 1531, becoming one of the first of the great tradition of English martyrs that takes place in the context of the English Reformation. So White Horse Inn, very significant as putting ideas into the hands of young men. Where that becomes important for the later English Reformation is, as the king is pushing his own political reformation from the top, the guys he recruits to help influence it are men who've operated within the White Horse Inn circle. And so you have a very anti-papal but Catholic monarch who, ironically, brings into positions of power men who are influenced by Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, and the rest. Okay, last point before we close for the day. I want to go back to Erastianism. Erastianism, the notion that the church is a subordinate arm of the state. The idea grew and developed in, well, it's partly articulated by John Wycliffe It's also articulated in the 13th and 14th centuries in Italy, as you have the rise of Italian city-states, you have men who are interested in arguing that the Catholic Church is to be subordinated to the power of the local magistrate. This will provide the English crown with the perfect idiom for Reformation. By the time we get into the 1520s and 1530s, the King of England, Henry VIII, is married to a Spanish princess. She's actually the aunt of Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor, lady called Catherine of Aragon. Catherine of Aragon has failed to produce a male heir for the king. She's had a number of miscarriages and stillbirths. She's finally given birth to a daughter. She's failed to produce a male heir. Now, knowledge of biology was pretty primitive in the 16th century. And the way it went was this: women, you will not surprise you to know that women lose both ways. Biologically, women were considered to be nothing more than a receptacle into which the husband placed a homunculus, a tiny little person who grew. So the women provide no what we would now call genetic material. So all a man does is place a tiny little man inside the woman, and that man grows. So the women provide nothing of any value. But if the woman failed to produce a male heir, it was regarded as a curse on the woman. So women lose both ways. They do nothing, and if they don't produce a male heir, they get in the neck anyway. Henry VIII is convinced that his wife's failure to produce a male heir is the result of a curse that lies on their marriage. And the reason the marriage is cursed is this: Catherine of Aragon was previously married to his older brother Arthur. Arthur was the man born to be king. Arthur dies relatively young, married to Catherine of Aragon, and Henry marries Catherine of Aragon once she's left behind. Why does he do that? It's a brilliant political move. It pulls England into an alliance with Spain, because England's enemy is always, with the exception of the 20th century when it was Germany, both in war and in football, who is England's traditional enemy? The French, of course, the French. And if the French are enemy, who's your great ally? Spain and the Holy Roman Empire. So Henry marries Catherine of Aragon. They have many years of what appears to be happy marriage together. She cannot produce a son and heir. And Henry becomes convinced that his marriage is cursed. Why? Well, the Old Testament is complicated on the issue of marrying your sibling's spouse. Some texts suggest that you should do it in order to raise up children for them. Other texts suggest that it's an abomination in the sight of the Lord. And Henry becomes convinced that he's committed an abomination in the sight of the Lord. And so he decides to ask the Pope for a divorce. The Pope is in a difficult position. The Pope is in a difficult position in two ways. One, he's in a remarkably weak economic, military, and political situation on the continent. And who's the powerful guy on the continent? If it's not the Pope, it's whom? Who? Who is? Charles V. Whose aunt is? Catherine of Aragon. The Pope is caught in a tight situation of granting a dispensation for divorce and insulting the emperor's auntie. The Pope is also in the slightly difficult position because the Pope already had to suspend church law to do guess what? Allow Henry to marry her in the first place. So you have this perfect storm of church law and dynastic politics settling over the head of Henry VIII. I've given you the longer story there because sometimes it's said the English Reformation is just driven by the fact that the English king wants to sleep around. He wants to get rid of Catherine of Aragon and bring in a newer model, which he certainly does. But I also think that Henry does genuinely believe that the marriage is cursed because he married his dead brother's wife. It's not a million miles away from what we were talking about earlier on the Westminster Confession. So that's the scenario. Next week, we'll see how it plays out. And to cut to the chase, it plays out with a lot of people having their heads chopped off at various points over the next 20 years. Don't, I've not seen it because I'm told it's pretty sleazy, but don't believe anything you see on the HBO series The Tudors. I'm pretty sure that that will be entirely fictional.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.